Hey, welcome to Throwback Thursday. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me one more time as we fire it up and light it up on the Life 2.0 podcast. I wanted to get a Wednesday rant in, but some technical difficulties got in the way of that. I figured all those out, and by that time, it's like, 5 o'clock on Wednesday? So a little late, but I figured, you know, maybe a Throwback Thursday might just be a better idea. The whole concept, of course, of Throwback Thursday is people go back to a time and a place and a space where they already knew how the outcome was going to take place. That sounds like a rhyme in a poem. I didn't mean it, but I live with it. And I get a kick out of Throwback Thursday. I don't look like I used to way back in the day, but there's a part of me that still feels the same. And I think emotionally, the concept of Throwback Thursday, I don't even know who started it. I have to look that up. Is that, you know, we get a chance to just kind of roll the clock back and remember things that at the time may not have seemed significant, and yet over time they become real significant. Pictures of my kids and my parents and my grandfather who came from Sweden with just $19 in his pocket. Matter of fact, his picture's right here in front of me. And all the stuff that goes on, we go take a chance to roll back things a little bit and kind of get some perspective. So that's the concept, at least as I see it, on the Life 2.0 podcast Throwback Thursday. I don't do enough of these. I do have all this audio sitting in my audio vault. It just takes a little bit of energy and effort to clean it up. And since we ran out of time yesterday, it was a good idea to do it for today. And so with all the turmoil and the upheaval in the world with the recent attacks in New Zealand and all that seems to be part of our landscape at this point, perspective really is everything. And I was digging through the archives and said, okay, what can I bring to the table for Throwback Thursday that is a voice of reason, a voice of sense when there's a very senseless act committed, a voice of peace in a very violent time? Who would I like to talk to? Who could I bring forth? And there's a lot of people that I've spoken with over the years on radio, back from my AM radio days and at the Oprah radio days, and then I did the WGN days and the CBS days, and I was on CBS podcast in 2015, from 2015 to 2017 and a half. I did 35 episodes there, and it was kind of my first foray into the concept and world of podcasting. I started looking in that file because there's a lot of great people in there, and I thought, here's one that might work. Anybody listening to this podcast knows the name Mahatma Gandhi, and as the harbinger of peace in a very, very violent time, he would be a guy that I'd like to sit down and talk with at some point. Well, that's not going to happen. But the next best thing is his grandson, Arun Gandhi, one of his grandsons. I believe it's his fifth grandson, Arun Gandhi. And I've known Arun a very long time, did a couple events together and like that. And so in 2015, when I was putting together the lineup for the, at that point, it was called Life Matters on CBS, he was one of my guests that I wanted to have on and talk. And this is a guy who runs around the planet literally he's like Dr. Jane Goodall. They're gone 340 days a year. All they do is live their passion and their purpose. That's what they do. They don't sit around watching the news at night and they're at fundraisers and events and speaking. And so those are the people I like to have conversations with because they see things far different than we do, especially a guy with the last name of Gandhi. So I went back, I did some editing, which was part of the technical problem I had yesterday, and I was able to get that rectified, certified, and bona fide, so we got it up and running. And I went in and started editing out this conversation I had with Arun Gandhi from 2015, so 4 years ago. At that time, you're going to hear some references, which is kind of what Throwback Thursday is all about. At that time, the Paris attacks had occurred in November, so we were just a couple of weeks past that, I believe. And that's when bombers struck and 130 people were killed, 494 were injured. Assault rifles, explosives, the whole nine yards. They targeted six locations. It was a goddamn bloodbath, as they always are. And so this conversation was on the heels of that horrific event. And yet in all of that, the conversation I had with Arun, I found full of hope. Because it is all about perspective for me. Also mentioned in this broadcast that you're going to hear, this Throwback Thursday episode, was a mention of something that happened in Kenya, also in 2015. 148 students were killed at the Garissa University. made no headline. I didn't hear about it. You're going to hear me talk about this before. This is the kind of stuff that happens. I'm listening 4 years later to stuff, and I'm going, damn. First of all, things ain't getting any better, but I don't even know if they're getting any worse. We're just able to get it quicker and faster. And there's something to do with social media, which has become very unsocial, that I think has an element to this. So what you're going to hear is this conversation I had in 2015 with Arun Gandhi. It talks about what happened in Paris. More importantly, though, it talks about the lessons he learned from his grandfather. And even more importantly than that, how we, you and I, can apply these lessons in our own lives so we don't have to feel like a victim all the time. That there's some way, somehow, we can be involved in the peace process. I see this all the time. I hear it all the time. And there's videos all over the place of, you know, I wish the world was a more peaceful place. Well, the truth is, for about 98% of the world, it is. There's 7 billion humans on this planet. And we see what's going on with just a very few. Is it horrible? Hell yes. It's terrible when 50 people are slaughtered. I'm not going to drop the F-bomb, but I could. It's terrible. And then look in perspective and go, well, there's 7 billion of us. So how do you measure peace? Will there ever become a time, as John Lennon said, that, you know, we kind of get our ass all in one place and our shit in one sock and everybody's doing kumbaya? No. Nice thought. Not in any sort of realm of possibility that I see. However, that doesn't mean you don't strive for it. I don't think that it means that you dismiss it wherever you are right now, whether you're in line at the bank or you're getting gas at this gas station or run across somebody on the street. We can be part of the peace. We should be part of the peace all the time. So when these things that happen that are so violent, at least we know we're not a victim. And I'm not talking about the victims of the events themselves, but think about it. And I say this all the time. If there's an issue that's really bothering you, don't just sit back and flamethrower it. Don't just dump gas on the fire. This should be different. Somebody should be doing this. I'll tell you what happens. When you become the person that does something about it, even if it's just a little percentage, you don't have time to sit around and complain about it. That's why Arun Gandhi travels the world spreading the message of peace that he learned from his grandfather and the lessons that he's learned from other leaders like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. There's a great power that comes when you're living your purpose and your passion. You don't have time to sit around and go woulda, coulda, and shoulda. So from November of 2015, here's my conversation with Arun Gandhi, and then I'll come back on the other side of it and finish this up.
Welcome to Life Matters with John St. Augustine.
We're going to talk with newsmakers and rule breakers and ground shakers and risk takers and see if we can't just find out really what's going on in the world in conversation that's not just about victory or who's right, but actual progress. If you're looking for a little inspiration instead of desperation, you found it.
This is Life Matters.
Hey, welcome back to Life Matters. Because I think that the, and you know, obviously I'm biased, of course, it's my show. I think that the 50 to 55, 58 minutes at most we get a chance to spend time together each week, hopefully in some way, shape, or form, informs you, inspires you, maybe entertains you a little bit. But the whole idea of this, and always has been, every show that I've ever done on the air since I started in 19, it was in the last century, let's put it that way. Has always been about those three things: informing, entertaining, inspiring people to kind of look at the world and ourselves and the role we play in the world different than we normally do. It's way too easy to get into a coma. I mean, it happens instantaneously. With all the amount of technology at our fingertips, the numbing and dumbing down effect of information we possibly can't use. Look, I want to spend the time I have, whatever time that may be, looking at things that come to something instead of things that come to nothing. And here we are just about 2 weeks away from the Paris attacks, the carnage, the slaughter again by terrorists who, in my opinion, have a leverage point against the rest of the world, and that is the illusion that it could happen anywhere at any time. And while that may be true due to the way it's covered, I also think that without going rampant on fear and getting into a mode of not reaction but responding in a different way can go a long way to hopefully offsetting this. I don't know that you're never going to stop it all. What we're going to look at today, though, is ways that we can each of us maybe do something about that in a way that works within the ripple effect concept, and that maybe by living our lives differently and looking at our lives differently, we can somehow, in some way, shape, or form, affect the whole, affect the macro by living in the micro. That's really all we can do. Outside of getting on Facebook, which millions of people will do, and putting up, support for Paris posts, that's all well and good. And that, for most of us, is a reaction thing. There's a difference between reacting and responding. Reacting comes out of our emotions. Something happens, you get cut off in traffic, and you're already swearing a blue streak before you can even think about it. It's a reaction. It's a knee-jerk reaction. These days, especially after 9/11, anything that smacks of terrorism or this type of activity, we've become like Pavlov's dogs. Pavlov would ring a bell and a dog would drool and he'd get something fed, and pretty soon he would ring a bell and the dog would drool and he wouldn't get any food, but drool anyway. So even now, when things are happening, that media bell goes off, we start drooling all over ourselves. Then when something else happens that really has meat to it, we're not really sure how to react. But past all that, and getting out of the emotional part of it, and getting into maybe the intellectual or spiritual aspect of life, and learning how to respond to things, maybe that is the key. Maybe that is the straw that breaks the proverbial camel's back when it comes to these type of activities in the world. When I was getting ready to research this show today, and I've rearranged the schedule to make sure that this gets up on the air in some sort of timely fashion, I was reading about an attack that happened in April of this past year. And 142 students were slaughtered in their college in Kenya. And I didn't hear anything about it when it happened back in April of 2015. I didn't hear anything about it in May or June or July or August, September, October. And until the shootings in Paris, all of a sudden this thing pops up all over the web. And it's about 142 students killed in Kenya. Where's the outrage? There was 148 dead total with security and police, but it was 142 students gunned down in their college. And of course, it's the same pattern that happens with these distended humans that feel like that they're in pain, they're going to go out and kill the rest of the world. And I look at this stuff and I go, is it possible that we only get outraged when there's things close to us or people that look like us? I don't know about that. I'm broadcasting here in Chicago. I'm on the 10th floor and CBS overlooking the lake on a kind of a cold and dreary, rainy day. But this city just buried a 9-year-old last week who was just in the alley playing basketball, and apparently it's retribution for his dad being in a gang. So whatever, when a human gets to the point where they can pull a trigger against another human, and the carnage is whether it's one or 148, there's a disconnect there. And I don't know how we get people who are disconnected to become reconnected with who they could be and not who they are at present. So one of the great things about this show over the years, and doing radio for two decades now, I've been able to have conversation with people who have great, not only influence in the world, but they have taken on work in the world that is far bigger than what they probably ever thought they would. And I met Arun Gandhi probably 15 years ago through various friends and a couple of events. And he, of course, is the fifth grandson of the great Mohandas Gandhi. And he has taken on the role of being the guy who carries the banner for nonviolence, much like his grandfather did. And so when you get a chance to talk to the fifth grandson of Mohandas Gandhi, you know, you might want to listen, because this is the kind of voice that cuts through all the rhetoric and all the BS out there and all the news channels and all the media and all the garbage, because this is a man who literally travels the world, not just promoting nonviolence, but being an advocate, being someone who lives it, being someone who understands it. And he is someone who says that, and he and I were talking before we started doing the show, that maybe now more than ever, this is needed. And he joins me this morning. Arun, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
My pleasure. And I wish it was always under different circumstances. One of the first things I thought of is, you know, you've taken on this enormous burden, really, in some ways, a curse and a blessing at the same time. What do you do for fun at 81?
Well, there's very limited amount of things you can do at 81, but I'm blessed with good health. And I try to maintain the good health by going to the gym and spinning.
Wait. You go to spin class?
I do.
Oh, wait a minute. I got to get a picture of Arun Gandhi on a bike in a spin class. Do you do the music and everything?
everything.
I love that. You know, years ago, you told me a story, and I think this is so profound for people to understand. In my opinion, this is what I got out of it. The story about your father sending you to town back when you were a teenager, something about to get an automobile fixed or whatever, and the lessons that came out of that that really, I think, kind of still play out in your life today. Would you mind sharing that with folks?
No, it's okay. In a very way, particularly because, you know, it indicates how we perpetuate violence, the culture of violence. That is the way we parent our children. And the first seeds of violence we plant in the children when we punish them for misbehaving. And this story that happened to me, I was 16 years old and I was living with my parents in Phoenix, South Africa. And Phoenix was at that time in wilderness. We didn't have anybody our age to play with and relate to. And so my two sisters and I would often look for chances to go to town and visit friends and see a movie. And we didn't get these opportunities very frequently because in those days, driving 18 miles just to go and have fun was not a doable thing.
Right.
It was a very expensive proposition. So one Saturday, my dad had to go to town to attend a conference, and he didn't feel like driving that day and asked me if I would drive him into town, and I jumped at the opportunity and said yes. And since I was going into town, my mom gave me a list of groceries to buy, and on the way into town, my dad reminded me of all the little chores that had been pending, like getting the car serviced and oil changed. And he said, since you have the whole day to yourself, will you please attend to all of these things? And I said, okay. And when I dropped him off at the conference venue, he said, at 5 o'clock in the evening, I will wait for you outside this auditorium. You pick me up and we'll go home together. And I said, okay. And I rushed off and I did all the chores and bought all the groceries and did everything I had was expected to do. And being a 16-year-old, I went straight to the nearest movie theater. And got so involved in a matinee show that I didn't realize the passage of time. The movie ended at 5:30. And I ran from there, got the car, and rushed to where my dad was waiting. It was almost 6 when I reached there. I was 1 hour late. And naturally, he was anxious and wondering what happened to me, and he walked pacing up and down. And so the first question he asked me is, why are you late? And instead of telling him the truth, I was so ashamed to tell him that I was watching a John Wayne double feature that I had decided to lie to him. And I said the car wasn't ready. I had to wait for the car, not realizing that he had already called the garage and asked him. So when he caught me in the lie, he said, there's something wrong in the way I brought you up that didn't give you the confidence to tell me the truth, and you felt you had to lie to me, and I've got to find out where I went wrong with you. And in order to do that, he said, I'm going to walk home 18 miles. I'm not coming with you in the car. There was absolutely nothing I could do to make him change his mind. He just started walking. It was past 6 o'clock in the evening. It was already getting dark. Much of those 18 miles were through sugarcane plantations, dirt roads, late night, no lights. I couldn't leave him and go away. So for nearly 6 hours, I was crawling behind him in the car, watching him go through the pain and agony for a stupid lie that I uttered. And I decided there and then that I was never going to lie again. And I think that was a very profound lesson in nonviolent parenting. If he had punished me like we would punish our children when we catch them doing something wrong, I don't think I would have learned the lesson. I think I would have just suffered the punishment and made sure the next time I don't get caught. But by taking the responsibility on himself and through his love and respect for me, the lesson that he taught me was so profound that I can still remember it so many years after the event.
Do you ever think, I mean, what's the other side of that story? Eventually you got home, the reconciliation. Were you able to tell him how profound that lesson was before he was gone?
Yeah, when we reached home, of course, my mom was very concerned, longed to get home. And in those days, we didn't have the telephone, the, you know, cell phones to call and inform them. So they only learned about what happened when we reached home.
Mm-hmm.
And then we all sat down and talked about it, and I apologized for the thing, and you know, they explained to me why it's important to be truthful and so on. So we had a very nice discussion. But the key to this kind of thing is that there has to be love and respect and understanding on both sides, from the parents for the children and from the children for their parents. If there is no love and respect, you know, then this kind of thing will never work then.
Mm. You know, it'd be too easy to say, and by the way, Arun Gandhi joining me. Are you in Georgia? Are you in Atlanta?
No, I'm in Rochester, New York.
Okay. And we're talking about, we're going to get to all this, about the season of nonviolence and the foundation, all the work you've done. But before we jump into all that, you know, you brought this whole thing up, and I asked you that to tell that story for a reason, because I'm all about... how things grow from the ground up, from the root up. And I use the metaphor when I go out and speak about, you can pull all the weeds out you want, but if you don't pull the roots out, they're always going to grow back. And that's a good thing or a bad thing. And when you look at the root of parenting, or when you look at the way the world is today, on one hand, it would be way too easy to say, oh, the world's changed, and that, you know, that's a fantasy land. But the truth is, there are still people that are doing a good job and a great job raising their kids in a very difficult world, on one hand. And on the other hand, we see more and more evidence, it looks like, of that disconnect, what you talked about, between parent and child. I don't know what the outcome is. I don't know if you heard me talk about earlier, but just a week or two ago, a 9-year-old boy was shot and killed in an alley here in Chicago. And supposedly it was the retribution because his father was in a gang. And when the father was asked about it, he said, I don't know what you're talking about. And that if somebody would be willing to clam up over the death of a 9-year-old boy who still had the basketball in his hands, you wonder, where did he learn that? And where did he learn that? And you got to dig down to the roots of these things, because when I see an event take place, I know that it started long before the event actually happened. The planning, the thoughts, how somebody wakes up in the morning and thinks they're going to, you know, be a jihadist. I don't understand it because I don't have those roots. But isn't that really what we're talking about here, is that getting down underneath the fingernails of all this and lifting up the sewer lids is the only way to change it?
Yes, it is. I mean, we have created a whole culture of violence to suit our needs, because our needs are quick resolution of a conflict. We want to control people, so we want, the only easiest way to control people is through fear. And so at every stage of our life, from everybody right from the government down to parenting, we are controlling each other through fear. And that means that we have to keep escalating the level of fear all the time so that we can control the people. Now, our justice system is based on that kind of control. So it's not justice. What we are seeking is revenge. We want somebody to pay for what they have done. And that, you know, just creates that whole culture of violence that eventually takes over our life. And so in every situation, we just want to be violent to get retribution.
Mm. You know, it's interesting to me, the concept of forgiveness. We see these stories happen in the news where guy walks into an Amish school and shoots a bunch of kids and they forgive him almost instantaneously. Mm. We see when the Pope, the attempted assassination on the Pope, and he goes in and forgives the man who shot him. We see these things crop up now and again, and they seem to kind of get through, which is way a ways from, you know, the bloodlust that happens when the retribution you talked about kicks in. So I wonder if we're in some sort of evolutionary phase, Arun, when we talk about here's the philosophies we want to try to aspire to. Nonviolence and forgiveness is the way to change it. And over here, some of the most popular television shows in America are all about violence. So it's like, it's this constant juxtaposition. We see in real life these things happen, and people take actions that most people can't even believe, which is, I forgive you for killing my son. And over here, that night on the news, we see 50 examples of the opposite.
Yeah, that's because everybody is subscribing to that culture of violence, and forgiveness is something that we have forgotten about. It seems they painted it as a weak response to any crime, and yet if we look at all the religions of the world, every one of them talks about nonviolence, peace, about forgiving, and a different way of life. But what we do is we worship and we pray, but we don't want to practice it. Mm. We don't want to incorporate that. We'll go 10 times a day and pray come back, but the moment we step out of the place of worship, we are different people. We respond back and again into violent situations.
Mm.
And that is the tragedy. We don't want to incorporate the prayers, the scriptures into our life. Now look at the governors today. They're all talking about not wanting the Syrian refugees, and yet they call themselves to be Christians, and that's not what Christianity talks about.
It's interesting because as soon as that Syrian passport was found among the terrorists in Paris, all of a sudden every Syrian refugee is on notice. It's just, again, I don't know if you heard me talking earlier, this is the difference between reacting and responding.
Yeah.
And reacting is, we're going to shut all this down because all of them are X, Y, and Z. And these seems to be actions that are repeated over and over again. Oh, I'll give you Chicago as an example. The governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, said no Syrians. I don't know when they're going to lift the ban. We're done with that and for X amount of time. And yet in the very city I'm broadcasting at, 16 people are killed every week by gunfire.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's almost ridiculous to say, this happened over there and they found a passport of a Syrian nature. And now all Syrians, and you can fill in the blank over the years, all Italians, all blacks, all Indian, you name it.
Yeah.
It's the same thing over to going. Arun Gandhi is joining me on Life Matters. We come back. I want to talk about your grandfather. I want to talk about the work of the foundation that you put in place. And specifically, as I've gone online and looked at some of the talks that you've given, I want to discuss the concept of this very, very violent world that we have created. It just didn't fall out of the sky. We do this to ourselves. And how maybe some ways people can literally, physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, actually put into practice what you talk about. We're talking with Arun Gandhi on Life Matters, back with more right after this. We live in a very, very violent time. Now, that being said, I don't know if it's any more or less violent than it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago. I think each generation has its challenges, and when you, I don't know if we kill each other anymore. We just found out maybe different ways to do it. Instead of doing it in the streets all the time like a gunslinger, we use drones now, and technology has given us the opportunity to kill from a distance in ways we never could before. We live in a violent time, especially when it comes to seeing all this stuff on the news. When I was a high school kid, my cousin was in Vietnam. And it was the first time that body bags were ever shown on the news. And back then we only had, in Chicago, 2, 5, 7, and 9 for news. And so you saw some of it, but it was not the plethora and the bombardment constantly that you can't really get away from the images that come forth. And it is, I don't know how much the human psyche can take when it's just this constant download of things. And I think it leaves us almost inept in a way to have some sort of responses. That it's easy to react, kill them all. It's easy to react, deport them all. It's easy to react, build a wall. Hey, now there's a slogan: kill them all, deport them all, build a wall. Sounds like some people I know running for president. Anyway, when you look at all these things, we say, how do we pull back and respond? What other ways could we do this? And there was one man, of course, in history. There's just a few that get to bend history. And, of course, the great Mahatma Gandhi was one of those men who did that. And he said, and I quote, that the weak can never forgive, that forgiveness is an attribute of the strong. And I think that's done at a level one-on-one. I think it's done at a level of societies. I think it's done at a level of countries and certainly on a global level. We all have to find out ways how to do that in our own lives. And a gentleman who has figured that out joins me on Life Matters, Arun Gandhi. Arun, you know, that concept or that quote that your grandfather said, that the weak can never forgive, that it's an attribute of the strong, we see these as opportunities to invoke that. And yet, it seems like in some ways, I don't know if we're ever going to get there.
No, we're never going to get there because we are constantly living in fear. And the media and the government and everybody else is trying to put fear in everybody all the time. You see now every day in the news, they're talking about what can happen to us and how we have to be careful. And you know, that fear complex that is generated all the time is making us weaker, and therefore we can't forgive anybody. We just have to seek, you know, revenge. And that is only what is happening to us now is the culture of violence is taking deeper and deeper roots in us. And I say culture of violence because it has dominated every aspect of our lives. We tend to look at violence only in the physical form, all the wars and killings and murders and rapes and all that, but we don't look at violence as the non-physical in the non-physical form, our relationships with each other, the hate, the prejudice, the anger, the frustrations that we feel, the way we relate to each other, all of these things are violent. And, you know, we are constantly practicing this against each other, and that is what is creating terrorism, criminals against us. And then we provide them with the weapons to do whatever they want to do more easily.
Mm. Let me ask you about your reaction to, I kind of know the answer, so I'm going to pretend like I don't. But when you turned on the television and you saw the reports coming out of Paris, what were your first thoughts about all that? And how did you follow up? Because I know that you're always writing columns and you're always speaking and doing things. I've looked at a couple of the YouTube videos when you were talking about other things that have happened in the world. But here we are again. It seems like that the names have changed, but the faces haven't. The ability for certain people in the world to disrupt the rest of the world is seemingly getting easier and easier. What were your first thoughts about all that happened?
Exactly what my thoughts were at 9/11, when 9/11 happened. You know, it was almost deja vu. When 9/11 happened, I was seeing it happen in front of my eyes. And moments later, my feeling was that this is not the time when we need to seek revenge. We need to find out why these people hate us so much and want to do such harm to us. And I even wrote a column about it. And, of course, nobody wanted to print that because that they were all so angry with the situation that this is not the time to talk of peace. And so that column never saw the light of day. But I went around talking about it, and many people realized that that was the right way to do it. I said, we've got to do some introspection to find out why are they so angry with us, and why are they determined to destroy us. They didn't wake up and say, we want to do this today and just disrupt life. It is an expression of their anger and hate and frustration. And we need to find out where it all comes from and how can we improve that. And I had the same feeling when the French incident happened. And I said, I just hope that they don't seek revenge and escalate the war. But they've done exactly what ISIS wanted them to do. so, to escalate the war. And ISIS is determined to draw us into a world war against and what they are going to describe as a war against Islam. And the more we get drawn into it, and the more innocent people we kill in the Muslim world, the more people are going to get frustrated and join this battle.
So let me ask you a question. So it seems there's an ideology, and I remember, I wish I could remember the guy's name on CNN when 9/11 happened. Anyway, he hit it right on the head. He says, we're going to spend billions of dollars to try and eradicate an ideology or a belief system that's been around for thousands of years, and we're playing right into their hands.
Exactly.
He said that, you know,
was 14, it Anderson Cooper?
No, I can't remember. Was it a comment? It might have been Cooper. Somebody said it on CNN years ago, and I heard it, and I said to myself, that's true. It's like, how do you fight against an enemy that has, that says, if you fight us, you're basically fulficling our prophecy?
Right. What we need to do is, why are they doing it? I mean, you know, they are doing this because of past history, the way they were exploited, the way we continue to exploit them. You know, the history is coming back to haunt us in the form of terrorism. So these, you know, these relationships with that part of the world where we exploited them for so many years and then left them hanging. Then more recently, we went and disrupted the whole of Iraq in a war that was not necessary at all. And now we are paying the price for it.
But if there are groups of people, or there are fractions of people who, you know, it's in some ways, I don't know if I can actually draw a straight line between, you know, the Third Reich and what these the thoughts of certain groups of people think that they're going to take over the world and do these things and they're going to fulfill their manifest destiny, as quirky and strange as that might be. You know, it's not like you could sit down and reason with Hitler, and I'm sure not going to draw a line between him and bin Laden. But you see these people pop up who have somehow skewed certain principles for their own whatever fulfillment, on a really bad way to put it, but they take this stuff and they make it work for themselves. It never ends up the way they think it will. I don't know if bin Laden ever thought he'd be caught, but the point is, quite frankly, I look at bin Laden going, you know, he's been gone, but he used to be the worst guy in the world, and now he's like a nothing. You know, what he did was terrible, but now we're getting into where it's like a hydra. And you cut one head off, and there's all these other heads left. We got to get to the point where we get to the tail and not just the heads. And how do you deal with people who are able to recruit? The guy that was responsible, apparently, for the Paris bombings and the attacks, there's a whole magazine on ISIS you can buy. I'm like, there's a magazine? He was interviewed like it's People magazine. So somehow this thing has gotten to a point where it's so attractive on some level that they're able to get people and young people from other countries to come and join up in something they have no knowledge of, and it's almost like a propaganda media type thing.
Well, you know, I also I often wonder about this. How could anybody get to a point of so frustrated that they have no respect for their own life?
Yeah.
I mean, how many of these young Muslim men and women are going and sacrificing their lives for their cause? What is it that has driven them to that point of desperation? I refuse to believe this popular notion that they've been promised virgins in the afterlife and all that BS. But you know, we have to think about this. What is it that is driving them to such an extent that they want to sacrifice their lives to do this?
But I mean, you could look at the same thing in Nazi Germany. Go, how do you get seemingly normal people to do such abnormal things? And I don't know where it's almost defies. Well, you have illogical people doing very illogical things, and the logical world goes, we don't understand.
Well, we are doing it in a more different way today. I mean, You know, our response to terrorism is also a violent response.
Mm-hmm.
And it all depends on how you feed the demon, and that demon then responds in that, more violently. So, we do the same things in a more polished way.
But so how, what do you think, and I just make, you know, you're as close to it as anybody on the planet. If your grandfather was still here and he was watching all that went on, and he watched what was going on in the world today and how this was all playing itself out, what would he be, how would he be responding to all this?
Well, he would certainly be frustrated with what is going on, and he would, but he wasn't one who would give up on anything. He would just believe whatever good we can do, we must do, and the effects of that will eventually bear fruit. And so he went on doing. You know, we in the modern world, we are so full of wanting to know the result of our actions before we take the action. And therefore, because we can't figure out the result of the action, we refuse to take the action. And so we never get to the point. But if we realize that result is immaterial, that we have to do what is right because it's the right thing to do, and if you go on doing it, eventually things will change. I mean, I give the example of Jesus Christ. When Jesus started his mission, he didn't wait to think of how many people he was going to influence. But he just went on doing what he wanted to do because he knew that was the right thing to do. And today we have half the world following his scriptures. So the lesson there for us is that don't get hooked up on the result of it, but do it because it is the right thing to do, and the results will eventually come.
Arun Gandhi is joining me on Life Matters. You founded the MK Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence back in 1987, and I know that you do this work all over the world. It's one thing, I think, for people to hear you speak and say this is kind of the big blanket we need to work under, but you know, for all the people listening to this show and the people that you run into, I think a lot of us like to know, well, what can we do in our own lives? How do we do this? How do we, you know, everybody's looking for peace. And I try to balance this out, look at the perspective issue. There's 7 billion humans, give or take a few hundred thousand, on the planet right now. And for the most part, most of us live in peace. I have a peaceful day. No one's shooting at me. All you got to do is look at the pictures of Syria and realize that, you know, we have it pretty easy, or any other war-torn part of the world. But it's a small group, maybe 5 million, I don't know, 3 million, 5 million, 8 million people that are not in peace, that live in this constant state, it seems to be, of war. Again,
you know, what you're talking about is only peace in terms of the absence of war.
Okay.
And that is not really peace. We are not really living in peace, even if though we may have a very easy day and calm day and there's no violence. We are committing violence against people all the time in a different way, in a passive way, by our strained relationships with each other, the way we discriminate against people, and the way we exploit people, the greed that we are so immersed in. We want everything for ourselves, and we don't care what happens to other people. All that is violence, and that is what I call the culture of violence. So even if we don't have any war here, it doesn't mean we are living in peace.
So it's almost like the concept that we're not starving, but we're hungry.
The thing that we need to remember is that nonviolence is not just a weapon of convenience. It's not something that we use when we want to and discard when we don't want to. It is a way of life. And unless we make that a way of life and practice it in our daily applications, right from our children to our friends to our colleagues to human beings to nature, we will never be able to create peace. If we can't create peace within ourselves, then we can't create peace outside.
And, you know, That concept right there is probably why I've always done these shows this way, to say, you know, the Mohandas Gandhis of the world, the Martin Luther Kings of the world, the great people that are doing this great work, they're the history benders in some way on a macro level. But on a micro level, each of us has the opportunity to find out who we are and who we're not, and act accordingly from that place. And that plays just as much of a role as it is the person who gets up on the podium or what have you and makes the speeches. It's living those words, not just speaking them sometimes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So the last few minutes we have here together, you know, I know that you've met with world leaders, and you've you know, everybody from the Dalai Lama to across the board. And you're in your 81st season. Did you ever think, in any way, shape, or form, when you were 16 and your dad walked all the way back with the, you know, you were following him in the car, that this is how your life would go?
No, not even in my dreams. But it just happened, and I just followed the path.
You spent
you
some...
Know, go ahead. Mother gave me a piece of advice when I was a teenager, and I told her, I don't know how I'm going to go through life with this legacy, which is already becoming a burden. You know, people were always expecting so much from us at that time. And my mom told me, she said, it's entirely up to you. If you consider this legacy to be a burden, it's just going to get heavier and heavier. But if you consider this legacy to be a light that's showing you the path, it'll be easier for you to deal with.
So
ever since then, I've been looking at this legacy as a light, which is showing me the path, and I'm following the path that the light shows me.
That's pretty profound. I mean, that's a great mom lesson right there.
Uh-huh.
I think all of us had that opportunity to do those things. What do you see? You know, you took on the mantle of your grandfather, and I know for many, many years, you and your wife, I was sorry to hear of her passing, did this work together. In some ways, I don't know that you're on your own, because you're surrounded by a great many people. But when you have those moments by yourself and you look at how far you've come, what do you think is, are we getting closer to the thoughts, to the concept, to the possibility, even with all the crap that goes on in the world? Has it taken hold enough, do you think, that we can move forward in some ways?
Well, as I told you, this is something very difficult to measure in terms of results, you know, what you do. And that's why I call myself a peace farmer. Like a farmer goes out into the fields and plants seeds and hopes and prays that he gets a good crop, I go out around the world and plant seeds of nonviolence and hope that they will germinate and I'll get a good crop of peacemakers. And I see, people affected by what I've said, they change, their lives have changed, they begin to think about it and do good things. So, you know, and there is hope. It's not altogether a hopeless situation.
Mm.
But, if you get stuck with the results, then you won't do anything at all. But if you are happy that you're doing the right thing and people are listening and accepting it in some ways, that is enough for me.
I want to thank you for taking the time today. It's been a very, very long break in between the conversations we've had. It's got to be a decade or more. And the last time we were together was in Michigan. You were speaking at a college up there. We had lunch. We're having this conversation. I'm thinking, this is as close as I'm going to get to the concept that Mahatma Gandhi was talking about, that you basically have become the embodiment of that, and that, as your mother pointed out, it is something to light up the world, not so much as a burden. And the one thing I came away with that lunch thinking, and I've brought it up many times over the years, and I want to thank you for that. It kind of happened by osmosis or organically while we were talking, is that I realized that I may not be able to change the world, but by taking on these principles and thinking of the things that we had conversation about and the things that you talk about and things that other people talk about, I have a better chance of making sure the world doesn't change me for the worse. And I think if all we come away with sometimes is keeping a middle ground and holding on to what we know is right and true for us, as opposed to totally giving up hope and becoming apathetic, maybe that's a win too.
Yeah.
I think so. Arun, it's great talking to you. I appreciate the time. You take care.
Thank you.
All right.
Quite an interesting and provocative conversation with Arun. I reached out to him on Facebook today. I want to let him know that this is going to be on the Life 2.0 podcast. I have not talked to him since, so it's been 4 years since he and I had a conversation on or off the air. And again, I am just heartened by this because this is the kind of stuff that never makes the headlines. Arun Gandhi speaking in some remote corner of the world about nonviolence does not make headlines. Violence makes headlines. It's a fight or flight response that we have. That stuff sells. Bottom line. Been in the media 20 plus years. I know what sells and what doesn't. And you know, that was the other thing. Listening to these shows, pretty damn good. The conversation's good. The production's good. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that should lift people up and move them in a new direction. When this show was canceled, I know it's happened to me 400 times. No, I'm just kidding. But when the show was canceled, I got this call from like the third or fourth guy in charge of the burgeoning podcast thing at CBS. And he's like, listen, you know, you're really amazing and you've done all these TED Talks and you're a very great guy and, you know, you're the next whatever. And I'm waiting for it. But you know what, John, people, they're not that interested in this stuff. What we're really looking for is, you know, the headlines. We want to, the politics and the sports. So he's right on some level. They wanted numbers. At my peak doing this podcast on CBS, I had about 25,000 downloads per show. I was impressed as hell with that. I mean, I thought, man, 25,000 people just to listen for 45 minutes on this little machine? Really? 25,000? That was the average. Sometimes it was more, sometimes less. That's nothing compared to the TMZ type stuff. There was a guy, Paris Hilton, I think his name was. He was getting 250,000 people listening to a bunch of garbage what Hollywood people were doing. I give a shit. Apparently, that doesn't work so much for me. So listening to this, I'm thinking, here's what we need. And this is one of the sticking points for Johnny here. That stuff grabs the headlines. It always has. You know, you go to checkout at the supermarket, there's always tabloid magazines, and people buy this stuff, and you feed on it, and it's like, to me, going to the garbage dump. You might as well just sit out of the garbage can. Doesn't change your life at all. Does it make it any better? Probably makes it worse. And you start watching this stuff and get wrapped up in it. It's like, you know, really? You're running on borrowed time, and you're worried about what some Hollywood celebrity's doing or whatever. Fill in the blank. When you could actually be making a concrete, constructive difference right where you're at now? I mean, to me, that's the priority. So doing these shows for me, as long as I've been doing it, that's the way I get to serve that. That if nothing else, on my deathbed, with one eye open and my middle finger up, I'd be like, I told you so. See, I left the F-bomb out. I did pretty good there. I told you so. And most people that I know get to the end of their lives, and they're like, that's it? Was it important that I was here? That's your job to make it important that you were here. Don't get stuck in the hamster wheel of worry. You know, and Ronald Reagan said it. I can't do a very good Ronald Reagan imitation. So I better not try it. But Ronald Reagan said, you know, and this really pertains to veterans, you know, everybody's born, goes through their life and wonders if they made a difference or that their lives mattered. And veterans never have that problem. And I agree with that because when you serve something bigger than yourself, when you have to put everything off to the side and say, I'm part of something greater than me, stuff changes. And so I'm not saying the military is for everybody. I was very proud to serve and I'd do it again in a heartbeat. Maybe I should have stayed longer. I'd have a pension. I wouldn't have to worry about some stuff. But the point is, we have an opportunity every day to serve something greater than us. And maybe we're not doing it. That's what Nate Boyer talked about, that earned Americanism. The fact that you were dropped off on this part of the planet, you beat the odds of 400 trillion to one to be born, but the fact is that it's one in one that you're going to die. What you do with that space in the middle, that's everything to me. It should be. I don't get it any other way. I don't see it any other way. I don't want to see it any other way. And on that note, here's Bill Curtis with Earth Matters.
There are at least 20,000 known species of bees in the world. But it's what we don't know about this amazing insect that might be one of the biggest challenges we face with regard to the environment in the next 20 years. A Cornell University study estimates that honeybees annually pollinate $14 billion worth of seeds and crops in the United States. Essentially, if honeybees disappear, they could take most of our insect-pollinated plants with them. The past 6 years have brought about a condition called CCD, or colony collapse disorder, an acceleration in the annual die-off of bees that some experts believe has to do with sprayed-on pesticides. While there are big problems when it comes to long-term sustainability, it might just turn out that the bee contains our greatest chance for survival. I'm Bill Curtis with Earth Matters.
We think we got it all figured out. See, that's my whole peeve with this thing about the climate and deniers. And it's not, we're too stupid to know. Even when we know, we don't know. I have friends of mine that know that their smoking's going to kill them and they still smoke. Nah, it's fine. And then when you got a pole up your butt and a tube down your throat, how come somebody didn't tell me that smoking was bad? We told you, it's on the side of the package. That's how humans are. So that little blurb there about the bees and the pollination, I did that for two reasons. One is because it needs to be reminded again to everybody, myself included. And you're hearing this one day after the first day of spring. And one of the things you could actually do that makes a difference, if you have a garden or a yard or even a flower pot in the city, is plant flowers that are attractive to bees. It helps them. So that doesn't take much. We're not asking you to go out and clean up the whole ocean or, you know, make sure all the clear cutting's not taking place in the rainforest or any of that other stuff. This is a very simple thing you can do. Next month, April 15th, if you're in Chicago, Bill Curtis and I will be doing an event at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago on Monday, April 15th. After your taxes have made you wonky, you can come over and join us. And we do this event called Earth Matters based on that radio show we've been doing since 2014, 13, somewhere in there. And really, it's the science and spirituality of ethical behavior when it comes to the planet. No politics, no corporate science and spirituality, and as ethically responsible humans that live on this planet and have to survive here. And when you start messing around with the life support systems of the planet, just because it hasn't happened to you, it like my friends who've been smoking for 40 years, think they get away with it. Oh, it caught them. And then they go, wait, what? And then they wonder why their insurance went up. You got to call it what it is. So for me, doing these programs and shedding a little bit of light and saying, look, I know there's a lot of shit going on in the world that's not good. There's always been shit going on in the world that's not good. And if I were to be Nostradamus, if you don't know who it is, go look it up. If I was to be Nostradamus, I'd say there's probably always going to be shit going on, unless there's only one of us here. And even then, we'd argue with ourselves over which side was right. That's how we are, unfortunately. But to be able to evolve within your own lifetime means becoming more conscious and more conscious of the surroundings that you have and the little bit of land that you might have been given. Even if it's in an apartment, you could put something out on your deck or something like that. And so just to have some sort of flowering plants that are attractive to bees, that keep that, at least that moving, then you're part of the solution, not part of the problem. So one more thing before I bug out, as always, this is a freebie. I'll get back to rolling out the subscriber-only Saturday stuff now that I got my tech stuff figured out. But this is a free program. If you've listened to this, and look, I watched last week a PBS special on my old buddy John Denver, and the phones were ringing off the hook. When they did the breaks, I actually turned the sound off because I know what they're doing. They're showing this programming that is emotionally attractive to people, and it gets them wanting to support the mission of public broadcast. That's great. It's the blueprint that I've thought might be the best way for me to do this. If you found this conversation with Arun Gandhi that you listened to for nothing worthwhile, then become a subscriber. Really, that's how it works. So you're listening to this free because about 45 other people pay for it. And there's your guilt trip. $20 a month, $5 a week, 66 cents a day. I spent, where did I go for I was at Portillo's, which is a major hot dog chain around here. I spent $24 and ate it all within about 9 minutes. That's a month's worth of programming. So I don't want to be a pitch man, but I have to, because I don't ever want to be in a position again like I was at CBS, where some guy who's the fourth guy that's been in the chair goes, John, what we're really looking for is a Hollywood stuff. No. No. So thanks to the subscribers for making this possible. I hope you will consider it. It's easy to do when you're on the website. You see anything that says subscribe to premium content. You click it. You put your credit card in. And once a month, you get dinged for $20. And you get to keep this stuff going out into the world. And I deeply, deeply appreciate it. Until next time, safe travels. Adios.